I'm your host, Dan Zintek. I am sitting here with Charles from JNC Leadership Consulting. So this is part of our leadership series that we're going to be discussing just some problems, current issues facing leaders, facing leadership in general. So Charles, thanks for having some time to get together. I know you've had a busy schedule of teaching a bunch of leadership classes, along with traveling with now we met with Mike last podcast. He does some travel with HR, and I know you have done some work with librarians.
Yes.
So tell me, I guess, where's the connection there, the leadership and librarian thing? How's that?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast, Dan. Looking forward to being here. So the connection with librarians, actually, I've done both leadership work with them, but also de-escalation. So part of my background in law enforcement is I worked with the mental health division, training on crisis intervention, recognizing when somebody may be in a crisis, mental health, emotional crisis, maybe substance abuse driven, and then teaching people how to interact with those individuals for safer outcomes. And when I was still working in law enforcement, I did a lot of training, not only for police officers and recruit officers, but also for non-sworn personnel in the city. So it actually started out with human resources, and then from there it grew, and I started working with Parks and Rec and libraries, and there was actually, I did a lot of work with Parks and Rec, but it's any division that wanted it. And then I started opening it up to all of the city for this training. And so when I left law enforcement, the idea of being able to bring in me as an outside consultant for de-escalation training and leadership training was something that I unknowingly had laid the seed while I was in the business, while I was in the profession. And then when I left, that's when I started getting phone calls.
So as far as the mental health part, so I know that this seems to be a focus. So one of the things we talk about is sort of current issues facing law enforcement and such. And there is a focus right now in reference to law enforcement agencies getting away from handling social problems, okay? Some places unpopularly have called it defunding the police, which the purpose, again, the purpose behind it was that other people should be handling some things that the police were doing, right? Problem was there wasn't extra funding put toward these things, and that has ended in a massive disaster. To that point, one of the biggest issues that seems to be trying to be addressed is mental illness, right? So you are part of one of those units, and I've seen a couple of different ways handled. I know that in one of the large agencies here in Texas, they would have a officer and they'd have a mental health worker. What was sort of y'all's program or how did y'all handle that in y'all's area?
So in Texas, all police officers should have received some form of mental health. It's a 40-hour class that you should receive. Now they mandate it in the academy. At my former agency, what we would do is we had, everyone was trained, but there were several officers dedicated to the unit specifically, and their role was not only responding to active calls, but also for follow-up. So these situations can be very complicated. There's a lot of issues surrounding mental health and really some societal challenges, access to treatment, access to medication. And then there's also certain individuals who choose not to seek treatment or medication. And as a result of not being treated or medicated, there are certain behaviors that can manifest themselves. And in some cases, those can be criminal behaviors. So the unit's goal where I was to really intercept those individuals and provide a lifeline to get access to resources when they needed them. And it wasn't just that. Obviously, some people were still resistant. And in some cases, there was an enforcement aspect to it too. We had a really good working relationship with our county, and in some cases we were able to, if one of the people that we were working with happened to get arrested, rather than them just staying in the criminal justice system and the revolving door, we were able to work with district attorney's office and actually get bond conditions that required certain treatments, follow-ups, things like that. And so our team included two officers and then also one licensed clinical social worker, who I will tell you that she's underpaid. In my opinion, she's one of the most valuable people at that police department, because a lot of people may not trust talking to an officer. She has an experience that some officers, or a perspective that some officers may not have. Some people are willing to talk to her that aren't willing to talk to an officer. But she also knows the system, and so she's able to answer and fill in a lot of blanks that we otherwise wouldn't have. And you're starting to see this model more and more in law enforcement, where social workers, clinicians are being dispatched in the field with an officer. And that's the key, is with an officer to approach these situations. Because in an ideal world, would officers respond to all mental health calls? Probably not. A lot of times these individuals are not committing crimes because they want to. It's because of basically an outcome of their mental illness. They're sick people and they're committing crime because of their illness. However, in some cases, those individuals can also be dangerous, right? They may be suicidal. And if they're suicidal, that means they may be also homicidal or willing to cause harm. There may be a weapon involved. And so really the ideal would be to have that clinician or social worker take the lead on those calls. It's really not a good idea until we know the scene is safe.
So now there's a couple school of thoughts on that. Were y'all a uniformed unit? I mean, that the officer going out, was he in a regular dressed uniform or was he in a plain clothes? I know that there's some thought on the presentation of an officer versus basically more casual dress and approaching these situations.
Well, my opinion and what we did was not the same.
Right.
So I was really just pleased that we were moving in what I believe to be a positive direction, get officers dedicated to this full time. They were part of a neighborhood unit, or you may have heard of like a community-oriented policing unit.
Right.
And so the dress for that unit was like a bicycle uniform. So bicycle pants, a lighter blue outer uniform, but they still, you know, obviously wore a vest. They obviously wore a Sam Brown belt with all the standard weapons that you would normally have. They drove around in marked squad cars, and I believe all that's still the same. But best practices, according to the Crisis Intervention Team International, really, if possible, they should be in softer uniforms. One thing you see a lot is maybe like a BDU with a shirt, like a polo shirt with, you know, with the patch or a badge logo on it. You still see them. Obviously, they still need to have protection. So I've seen a lot of agencies, especially in the North Texas region, that still have their regular Sam Brown and still wear the vest. But you also have examples like, if you ever seen Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops?
I've not seen this.
Okay, it's a great documentary. I believe it's an HBO documentary, and it's these two officers. It's been a while now, but from their mental health unit in San Antonio, and they were basically plain clothes. Now, they had a weapon, but they were basically plain clothes, drove an unmarked car, and the reason that this is considered a best practice is because there's such a stigma around mental illness. You know, people they don't like admitting that they have it.
Right.
And if the main reason that they're committing a crime is because they're struggling with a sickness, talking to a police officer, it looks, or especially if you go in the back of the car, it looks like an arrest. It feels like an arrest. And so it's embarrassing. And so when they have unmarked cars, softer uniforms, individuals are much more willing to trust and develop that rapport.
So what do you think some of the biggest challenges in addressing, developing that unit? Obviously, you have smaller agencies, bigger agencies, that type of thing. So as this comes up, we know it's a problem. We've seen this for years. I think some of the most dangerous calls I've gone to is when you get the naked man running down the street.
Right.
Because that's not normal.
They're usually bloody, very sweaty.
This is a mental health call.
Right.
But it is usually all on physical altercation when you finally get there, right? So what are some challenges in developing this? Going from the police response, okay, to, I won't call it a gentler, just a different mindset of addressing this.
There's no shortage of challenges. One of the things that is just in the nature of policing, that in the country, we have departments that vary in size drastically. We have anywhere between a one-person department to places like Chicago, New York, Dallas, LA that are, you know, have many, many thousands of officers. In the state of Texas, you know, most of the departments here are quite small. People probably don't realize that. Your listeners would probably know this, but most police departments have, what, less than 20 officers?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the vast majority. So dedicating an individual to that unit may not be reasonable if you only have two or three on the street at any given time.
You barely have enough to cover the calls.
Right.
So some type of specialty.
Exactly. You know, the second thing would be funding, right? If you're looking at, for those who don't know, Texas is consistently 48th, 49th, or 50th out of all U.S. states funding for mental health per capita, which is actually pretty absurd if you think about how much money Texas as a state brings in. So funding is an issue. One of the problems that I personally dealt with is too many times people associate mental illness and homelessness and think that they're basically synonymous. Well, you don't have to be homeless to be mentally ill, and you don't have to be mentally ill to be homeless, but sometimes they do intersect. In fact, that's pretty much the main ones that you will see causing problems, the ones that you get the common calls for service on.
Do you think that a lot of that is just due to the lack of a support unit? I mean, obviously, if they are homeless, there's usually not a connection to family. There's not a connection to someone, I guess, taking care of them, looking out for their needs, versus someone with mental illness that has family around them, that we're having more interaction with the people on the streets that don't have that support.
Yeah, well, you know, that could be a triggering conversation for some talking about these social issues, but the reality is that a homeless individual, really the appropriate phrase is somebody experiencing homelessness, a lot of times their social support is gone. It has deteriorated. In some cases, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist still. For example, it doesn't mean that person doesn't have a family. It may be that the family has been so worn out trying to care for this individual or help them that the family has basically given up. But that's not just true for individuals experiencing homelessness. That is also true for people who have a mental illness. In some cases, it gets very frustrating where over time you try to be a support system and that person's resistant and they push away. And at some point, the family kind of throws their hands up. So really the breakdown in family support or friendship, a contributing factor for both.
So with that idea, right, with the idea that we know there's an issue out there, and as most issues fall, when we don't have a solution, it seems to fall to the police to solve it. Right now, as you said, you know, well, we're recording in Texas here. We both have been Texas officers, and the course you're referring to is the CIT course.
Right.
And so everybody goes to it. We all had 40 hours of training.
Yeah.
And now what, right? I mean, so obviously this didn't solve the problem, okay? And as you said, there's some resources and funding and those type of things. Has it improved? Has it improved since we got the 40 hours? Has it improved with talking about it, knowledge of it, some things being put in place? I know that in one county that I'm near, they focused a lot of the ARPA funding from COVID towards mental illness and addressing that. But I guess, are we seeing a solution, or is the problem so big? I sort of relate it, and probably not rightfully so, but I sort of relate it to child abuse, right? Has child abuse gotten worse, or is it the fact that we're now paying attention to it? It's always been there, right? So in those terms of mental illness, is it improving, or are the numbers getting higher just because we have started identifying it more?
Those are some great questions. Then, quite frankly, I don't have the answers to any of them. I think that has our response gotten better to it? Absolutely. When you look statewide as a whole, I think so. Is it ideal? Absolutely not. Part of the issue is that the state of Texas has basically mandated, it's a course you're required to take. Historically, this course, the 40-hour CIT course, historically was a course you took after you were an officer for a little while. It was actually went by a different name, the Mental Health Peace Officer course, and it wasn't mandatory. Now, an agency might make it mandatory, but the state regulation body, TCOL, it wasn't necessarily mandatory through them. Well, now it's mandatory, and now it's mandatory in the police academy. So the way that our police academy worked was, I think it was at the time, 26 weeks. We were week 18. So they had gone through 17 weeks of learning law, tactics, you know, which includes ground fighting, command presence, all of these things you have to know as a police officer and be competent at. And then you go to this 40-hour class where we teach you to slow it down, recognize when somebody may be doing something not as a threat to you necessarily. They could be a threat, but they're doing this because they're in crisis. We teach you some different communication tactics. And then you go back for 8 more weeks about running, fighting, shooting, all this stuff. And so it's now wedged as just another requirement. You got to know the law. You got to know the traffic code. You got to know how to make a traffic stop. And then you got to know mental health. And for those of you who have never been through Academy, it's like drinking out of a fire hydrant. It's way too much information, but it's all necessary. The other problem that I think makes getting to a solution even tougher is the fact that there's 254 counties in the state. And so while you have one regulating body, TCOL, saying that this is mandatory, how do you make sure that all 254 counties and the cities within those counties do an adequate job of training officers how to recognize and respond? As a whole, I think we're getting better. I think we're recognizing that there's a need. There's certainly a lot of room for improvement.
Well, I think that's one of the problems, you know, you talk about with all the agencies, right? So there are, as you said, 254 counties, which count for Sheriff's Department. You have all constable agencies, then you have all the municipalities. So we're talking about thousands of agencies. And as you said earlier, majority of those agencies are less than 20 officers. Bringing the training to them, as you said, TCOL is our body here, and other states, it's whatever organization that license your police, may refer to it as post and those things. But taking the training, who's giving it, how often it's given, do you have access? I mean, there's some agencies out there that are one-man agencies. Mm-hmm. There's some that are a couple-man. And I don't know, maybe if there's a one-man agency, maybe it's in a rural area that you don't have the same amount of need for that. I think that's always been a problem with mandated things. Usually we look at something, we identify it as a problem, and then we mandate it as if that problem fits everybody. It's mm-hmm. happening everywhere, right? And so I'm not sure that when we talk about funding, when we talk about mandates, when we talk about those things, that one size fits all, right? And I don't know if what that solution looks like, but we do know that there needs to be, we need to address the problem, as it has been determined, and rightfully so, that police handling that on their own at a time that we're already having trouble with recruiting, we're already having trouble responding to calls because of recruiting issues, retention issues, this is more to address. And finding that solution without the funding, without the resources, seems to be the underlying foundational problem that seems to keep this problem going, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, there's just so much to unpack there, Dan. I mean, there really is that this, you talked about the mandated training. I've done a lot of training on a lot of different topics, and I know you're an experienced trainer yourself. There's some people who go through training, and even though their department or their organization is really, you know, supporting the training, they're paying for the tuition, they're paying for that person's salary to be there, it's hard in some cases to hold people accountable to their, to the actual taking the training seriously and really internalizing what they're learning, whether that's de-escalation, crisis intervention, leadership, no matter what it is. Just because somebody's in the room doesn't mean that they're absorbing. So mandated training, that's, it's kind of almost an oxymoron, because you can have a person go through the training and really choose not to learn anything if they want to. They can just sit there and get enough to pass the written test at the end. And that's kind of evolvement of, is that a word? We'll go with it. The evolvement of the course being a voluntary 40-hour course, you know, once that person's been on the street for a while, to now it's mandated in the academy. And I got to tell you that I've taught both classes, and typically the recruit officers in the academy love that week. They love the week because, you know, they got into the business to help people. They want, most people in this business want to help people who cannot help themselves. So these recruits are looking at this course like, wow, this person is having trouble and I can learn these techniques, and, you know, maybe they don't have to go to jail. Now, some recruits don't look at it that way, but most do. Officers, it took a little bit more. Like, on day one, you had a lot of people with their arms crossed. They'd be on their phone. You could tell by their body language they didn't necessarily want to be there. Again, not, it's not 100%. Some really wanted to be there. But by the end of the week, a lot of people are on board. Still, though, if you make it mandatory, that alone will make some people hostages in the class. Hostages meaning they don't want to be there. You also talked about this challenge, in addition to the fact we're dealing with retention, hiring, all those issues, recruiting. These calls take time. You know, I've personally been on scenes of homicides where I've been able to clear off within a few hours. I've been on mental health calls that have literally taken me 10 hours. And so you're competing against what people might, in, you know, quotations, call real crime, versus these other individuals who can't, it's not that they don't commit crime, it's just that it's a mental health crisis sometimes. And even within policing, some officers question the need for it, the crisis intervention. Some officers may question why people are taking so long on a call, if it could be handled in a, you know, as a criminal matter. So time on the call when you're already dealing with manpower or staffing issues is a challenge.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why there's the how long is it going to be and those type of things is the police mentality of, there's something there. Okay, we get it. They can't go to jail. Where do you want me to take them? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Not about the conversation. I'm not the solution. I'm going to put them in my car and let me know where the mental facility is that I can drive them to get back in service and get back on the call. Right.
Right.
And I think that hasn't totally switched yet. Right. I think that really is still out there as far as a thought process of it. That, okay, we have hospitals, we have emergency detention orders, we have these type of things. And that's because that's really about the only mental health solution we had in the past, mm-hmm. right? Someone was a danger to themselves or others. We put them in the car. we go get an emergency detention, we drop them off the hospital, and let's just face it, the similar to booking someone in jail.
It's just, yeah.
You know, and then I'm back on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, as you said, it takes a lot more time to work with an individual than process them and get back on the street, right?
And by and large, that's still how a lot of it's done. You know, some counties, these deputies are having to drive a long way to get to the nearest facility. And each county kind of requires a different approach. So in the county that I worked, the answer, at least when I left, was still take him to the emergency room. So now you're tying up already busy emergency rooms. And that wasn't necessarily my decision. That was kind of the agreed upon county decision. Whereas in the county basically right next door, they actually take them to an inpatient mental health facility. And it's a very different approach. And these are counties that are literally right next to each other. The time on the call is not just where am I going to go? How long do I have to sit there after I get there? But sometimes it takes a while to even get to a point where that person is willing to get in the back of the car with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the conversation I'm talking about, because in the past, we'd ask them, right? I mean, you're in mental health. You were treated the same as basically someone who had committed a crime.
Right.
We were going to detain you, no matter how many officers that took, and we will get you in the car, and we will drop you off to someone who can care for you in the way that we have no clue what we're doing and get you there. And I think what was sort of dismissed in many years is what further agitation, harm, or escalation that you've created by that environment versus the main things we've learned since then of trying to de-escalate and talk them down and have a conversation to see what we're actually dealing with along the way, right?
Yeah. And, you know, still the end result, even after we've done the de-escalation, a lot of agencies still have to detain that person in handcuffs. And that person still gets transported in the back of a marked police car with a cage and all that. So it still looks like an arrest, you know. I know certain agencies, depending on the situation, may take a different approach if they don't believe the person could be dangerous. Like you say, it's progress. It's just got a long way to go.
So changing gears a little bit, since that's one of our issues there, is mental health and police dealing with that. We've talked about for on the show a little bit as far as that we said retention, recruiting, and those problems that we're facing along the way. You get an opportunity in a class that you teach on leadership, and you have everyone show up from officers, deputies, all the way up to chiefs, and you get to have some great conversations with these people about what they believe the current problems are, and why we're having, I guess, issues or how to solve those issues. Out of some of the many conversations you've had, what would you say some insight on things that I guess we could do to improve people wanting to still be police officers, work in a police agency, work supporting their community? What type of feedback have you received?
It's a challenge. I think it's a countrywide challenge. The fact that the loudest stories you hear are typically the ones that are negative. You know, we don't really see a lot of positive police stories anymore in the news. I mean, I can't think of back to the last time I saw a police story that had a positive focus. Yeah, I think back to Anchorman. You know, they do a story on a squirrel, you know, water skiing, right? That was news back then, right? Jokingly, but seriously, today the news we don't see. So every agency that I run across is dealing with retention issues and hiring issues. I will say one exception, in the time that I've been teaching police leadership, there has been one department that has actually told me that they're fully staffed.
And I bet that's one out of how many agencies?
Hundreds.
Right.
Hundreds, yeah.
Yeah, easily hundreds of agencies.
Some are down as much as, you know, 20, 25%. And I think there's still a part of the issue, if I can be real frank, is that there's a disconnect between leadership and the front lines. The front line meaning the officer. If you think about it, at the core of a police department, who are your greatest recruitment assets?
Right, it's your officers.
It's your officers. There's no question. And so right now, there's a trend I see is that there's a lot of morale problems. And it's not just related to the climate. In fact, I think that if you surveyed most police officers and asked, what is it that stresses you out most, or what is it that you fear the most, they'll all point to their administration. And I've come across few exceptions. So the first step, I think, is there's a disconnect between leadership and the front lines. And one of the things that I like to talk about, I have taken this on from a mentor of mine, is we talk about in the room, and there's usually, like you said, anywhere from officer all the way up to chief in the room. We talk about what does Utopia PD look like? Like, if you could work for the ideal agency, what does that actually look like? And we talk about all these different things, and we let's see, this week I'm looking at the you know, we talk about a safe environment. Not safe as in not dangerous from the street, but like I feel safe to speak up and admit mistakes and put my ideas out there. There's compassion in the police department. There's no rumors or scandals. The list goes on. And then we compare that to what does reality PD look like? And let me just read a few of these things. Lack of self-care, negativity, empty promises. So there's a difference between, and these are not only officers, but this is the whole range of supervision. And what we're seeing is that people in this industry are hurting. So your best recruiting tools, and I don't mean to use tools in a negative sense, but the people who are your best recruiting agents, they're hurting, and they're not.
It's hard to sell something you don't believe in.
That couldn't say it better myself.
Yeah.
And again, I believe that every single person in these rooms, every single person I've ever met, well, I would say with a couple of exceptions, who gets into law enforcement does it because they want to help. They want to protect those who can't protect themselves. They want to catch bad people and put them in jail. And they want to serve the community. And yet we create a culture that makes them not even want to be there, you know?
So what do you think I say the solution, but what do you think is the common cause for that disconnect?
I think it takes two words. I think leadership communication is quite frankly the key there, because there are certain things in Utopia PD that get put out in the class that are not possible. Right. We cannot work in an environment where everybody makes $1 billion, drives, you know, floating cars, and where the community, everybody in the community, like Utopia, it just doesn't exist. In reality PD, there's certain elements of reality PD that I believe senior administrators may not be fully aware of. And so there's a communication disconnect where administrators are wondering why line officers and frontline supervisors see things a certain way, and frontline officers and supervisors are wondering why administration doesn't get it. And I think it's just a communication gap. I honestly think that if there was more transparent communication, now I get it. I left as a sergeant, so I am not going to sit here and tell you that I know that chiefs and assistant chiefs can open the books and just tell you everything, but they can at least listen, and they can at least try and fill in the gaps where it's reasonable. It's really, I think it just comes down to those two words, leadership, communication.
Well, and you made a comment as far as filling in the gaps. And I can tell you that our officers, no different than the media, do not accept no comment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That they want answers. And in many places, they deserve answers. And even if that answer is, I can't share all the details,
yeah,
but this is the end result. I don't need you guessing about it. This is decisions were made based on some things I can tell you, some things I can't. But it's having that communication and at least sharing that, because if you don't, then they will make their own assumptions on how you got to that decision. And again, this is not everybody. Some are going to be disgruntled. Some may have an issue with it, no matter what decision was made. But for the most part, my experience has been when you have that communication and conversation about what you can tell them, and let's be honest, it's not a big secret, okay? For the most part, there's a lot of things we can talk about. We can share with our employees. We can share the fact of things that we're planning for the future. We can plan things for their benefit, for the city's benefit, the county's benefit. We can talk about things that are upcoming in budget, things we'd like to do, things that, you know, those floating cars you talked about, right? Hey, we'd love them. We don't know where they're at. We don't know how much they cost. We probably can't afford them, right? But we'd like that too. We can have that conversation, right? And, you know, looking at some of the things that y'all had listed from Utopia, one of the biggest things, you know, transparent communication. And then when you look over reality of what they have, lack of communication, they have underappreciated, right? And a lot of that appreciation, I think, comes from a relationship, just understanding that they want to work for you. They want to serve you in the community, but they want to have some information to do so and not just be blind to it.
Yeah, you mentioned the word relationship. I think that, you know, leadership communication is really a symptom of a healthy culture. I think that the underlying prerequisite is relationship. Because if you want to have influence on anyone, in order to do so, you must have a relationship. And I mean this in if somebody who works in your chain of command, if you're expecting them to do something, not because of your positional authority, but because you would like them to do something, that relationship is going to be a foundational element. And this idea of communication, one common theme I see, and that is just, it's a nature of the human body, or the human brain rather. We don't like uncertainty. We really don't like a lack of knowledge. And so when our brain comes across a concept or a situation that it's unsure about, there's an information void, we don't really like that. We get uncomfortable with that, and so we fill that void in. But we don't do a good job of thinking, well, this could be positive, or maybe they have my best interests in mind, or, you know, maybe they really do want us to find the floating cars, and, you know, they think of the worst case scenarios. So whenever information is withheld, people will fill that in typically with worst case scenarios.
Well, and even if they don't fill it in, you know, we can't dismiss that. I promise, no matter where you are, police or any organization, you have a disgruntled worker. You have a person that's negative, and it doesn't have anything to do with work. They're just a negative person.
Right.
And they're just not a happy individual and never have been, and I feel very sorry for them. But they're going to be the ones that are filling in the blank. They're going to be the ones that make the comment on, well, they're doing it because of this, they're doing it because of that. And when you have a person in there that does not have the answer, and that's the only answer they've heard, it's sometimes easy to start logically connecting the dots to the negative person and how they feel.
Yeah. That's exactly right, because when you hear something that kind of sounds like it might be right, we have this thing called confirmation bias. We'll look to confirm the information that we already have that we believe is true. Very, very good point. I think there is hope for policing, though. I really think that, you know, like anything, it can go up and down in cycles or swing back and forth like a pendulum. I believe that there's still a lot of men and women out there who want to serve their community and will choose to do so through the profession. I also believe that right now we as leaders have a responsibility to pave the way for them to do it in a healthier environment.
Yeah, I think that, you know, certainly we all are facing recruiting. We're all facing a lack of staff. And, you know, my belief is that it is not, I think that a small portion, very small portion, is related to the media. Obviously, the media being out there does play negative stories of police, right? And there's a small portion that look at that and say, well, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we also are facing, as other places are, we see a shortage of nurses. We see a shortage of teachers. We see a shortage of people that are serving in many areas. And you don't have them on the news on a regular basis, right? The fact is we have a saturation of so many jobs and so many things that people can do these days that there literally are not enough people to do those jobs. And more importantly, we have never been and never will be the highest paid jobs out there, right? So I think that we're challenged with a workforce that is saturated with jobs, not enough people. And I think our biggest challenge coming up is just attracting people to serve the community, to serve police. And I think our recruitment efforts, our leadership of getting out there is a big solution to that.
I couldn't agree more. You know, one mistake I think I see with recruiting efforts is that they do try and highlight the pay, the compensation. Because while policing may not be the highest paid profession in the land, you're going to get paid more than a lot of other professions. At least the agency that I came from and the area that I worked in, you know, it wasn't uncommon to make six figures, even as an officer. And so my caution with that would be, don't send a recruiter out to say, hey, if you come work for us, within so many years, you'll make such and such dollars. If you just make the profession about the money, you're not going to be hiring the right people.
Well, they're not going to stick around either.
Right.
Because we've seen this. We've seen people come on looking for a job. We've seen people coming on looking for money. And then they go see what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You see people at their worst times in their life, very good people, but they're having a very bad day. And they're now part of your day.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a struggle for people that did not get into it for the right reasons.
Oh, exactly. If you, and think about it this way too, this is typically not a limited term career. People get into this business and then we tell you, well, you're going to have to work for 20, maybe 25 years. And then, you know, unless you save enough in addition to what we're matching with retirement, 20 or 25 may not be enough. So you're looking at maybe at 30, 35, in some cases 40, I've seen. So that's a long part of your life. And if all you're doing it for is the money, you go to work and you will very quickly get burnt out because you're dealing, like you said, day in and day out with people who are maybe excellent, good, solid citizens, but you're dealing with them at their worst. And that's your day every day, you know?
Yep. So, well, Charlie, I appreciate the time you've taken. We've talked about a lot here. We've talked about some of the issues with mental health that we're dealing with, some of the recruitment and leadership problems. I appreciate your expertise, many insights that you have. To wrap up, if you will just share about your company, things that you offer and how to find you.
Great, yeah. I've been really honored to be on the podcast. So my company is JNC Leadership Consulting. You can find me at jcleadershipconsulting.com. You can pretty easily search me on LinkedIn. Just search Charles Heasley with JNC Leadership Consulting. You can email me charles@charlesheasley.com. And the company offers a variety of services in consulting, training, and coaching. I do offer de-escalation training, but in addition to that, I have a lot of leadership-focused training. So check it out and let me know if anything can help your company.
All right, Charles, appreciate it, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Crime Scene Today. If there's a topic that you'd like covered, if there's a guest you'd like on the show, or if you'd like to sponsor the show, you can reach out to me at dan@crimescenetoday.com. Thank you for listening.